Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the Internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm George Scalise, a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your moderator for tonight's program. This program is part of the Commonwealth Club's series on ethics and accountability, underwritten by the Charles Travers family. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to you our distinguished speaker for this evening, Dave Walker, President and CEO of Come Back America Initiative and former U.S. Comptroller General. He served in that position as Comptroller General from 1998 until 2008, so served under both administrations of President Clinton and President Bush. He's the founder and president and CEO of Come Back America Initiative. It's a nonpartisan voice for lawmakers focused on correcting America's federal, state, and local fiscal imbalances. Among his many private sector positions, he was Global Managing Director of Human Capital Services for Arthur Anderson and was also the first president and CEO of the Peter G. Peterson Foundation. He's also authored three books, the most recent, Come Back America. Ladies and gentlemen, Dave Walker.
Thank you, George. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming this evening. It's always a pleasure to be at the Commonwealth Club. I think this is the third or fourth time that I've had the opportunity to address this club. And obviously, San Francisco is one of the most beautiful cities in the world, and today's a beautiful day. So it's a pleasure to be with you. I've got several friends here, former partners, as well as Bruce James, who was head of the GPO, the Government Printing Office, when I was head of the GAO, the Government Accountability Office. Pleased to see their faces. I want to acknowledge the Travers family who are sponsoring this series of lectures. It's about ethics and accountability, and just to comment on that to begin with. We have to keep in mind that the law represents the floor of acceptable behavior. It's not appropriate to crawl on the floor. We need to reach for the ceiling. And there are higher ethical and moral standards that we should strive for. Secondly, I found, especially being the Chief Accountability Officer of the United States government for 10 years as Comptroller General, that everybody's for accountability until you want to hold them accountable. Then all of a sudden they're pointing fingers the other way. So I think this being part of the Ethics and Accountability series makes a lot of sense. Let me start off with the two things that are on my lapel that have special meaning to me. The first is a rosette of the Sons of the American Revolution, of which I'm a member. My Walker family, and as far as I know, I'm not related to Governor Scott Walker. We'll get back to that later. But my Walker family came to this country in the 1680s in Virginia. And I have ancestors who fought and died in the American Revolution. The second one is Certified Public Accountant, CPA. The combination of the two, Sons of the American Revolution and CPA, means that I'm a patriot who can add. And quite frankly, we need more of them in government, especially at the federal level. I want to start off with a provocative statement, and then we'll go into some more details. The United States is a great nation, arguably the greatest in the history of mankind, but we're not as great as we think we are. We've strayed from a number of the principles and values that made us great. We're not learning from history. We're not learning from others. We face a range of key sustainability challenges that threaten our future position in the world, our future standard of living at home, potentially our national security, and even our domestic tranquility. Our political system is dysfunctional. It has been taken over by the wings and the ideologues. We have hyper-partisanship and a great ideological divide. Too many of our elected officials are what some refer to as career politicians, which to me is an oxymoron. The founders intended that people would have real jobs in the real world, do public service for a short to medium period of time, and then return to their real jobs in the real world. Today, a significant majority of our elected officials, no matter how good they are and how well-intended they might be, may or may not have had a real job before they get elected. But once they get elected, they want to keep it for life. And they're in Washington 3 days a week, which is a part-time job. And they spend a lot of their time raising money. And very little is getting done. And let me articulate to you some examples of the principles and values that we've strayed from and some of the challenges that we face. You know, this country was founded, among other things, based upon limited but effective government, individual liberty and opportunity, personal responsibility and accountability, rule of law and equal justice under the law, fiscal responsibility and intergenerational equity. And let me give you a word that we don't hear enough, and the word is stewardship. That word means that as a leader, whether you're in the private sector, the public sector, the not-for-profit sector, and I've had the good fortune of being a leader in all three, your job is not just to generate positive results today, not just to leave things better off when you leave than when you came, but to leave things better positioned for the future. That is much tougher. And the truth is, my generation, the baby boom generation, is failing on its stewardship responsibility to our children and grandchildren. Our fiscal policy, which is tax and spending, is imprudent and unsustainable. And I'll come back to that. But we face a number of other key sustainability challenges that we have to address. Our energy policy, our environmental policy, our infrastructure policy, our immigration policy, our health care policy, our tax policy. I could go on and on, but I've got a limited amount of time. The current path that we're on in all of these areas are imprudent and unsustainable. You know, we are the largest economy on earth. We're the temporary sole superpower. Our currency, the U.S. dollar, represents over 60% of the world's global reserve currency, and we issue debt in our own currency. All of these things mean that we're a powerful nation. Our culture is felt around the world. But we're not learning from history, and we're not learning from others. Other great civilizations and great powers have strayed from their principles and values and paid a price. We need to not follow their mistakes. If I look forward, I can see that as we look at the current state of the economy, we've got very high unemployment, higher underemployment, and weak economic growth. The truth is, unemployment and underemployment is a lot higher than the government tells you because of the way the government keeps score. And labor force participation is the lowest it's been in decades. And therefore, you have the ironic situation that if the economy starts to improve somewhat and you have more people start looking for jobs, the unemployment rate can actually go up even though more people are getting jobs, because it's the ratio of how many people are, you know, unemployed as compared to how many are looking for employment. And so we need to recognize that we have challenges at home. Europe is a mess, and it's going to have to work through its economic challenges, and I'm happy to answer questions on how I think they should do that. Growth is slowing in China, in India, in other parts of the developing world. And we are not an island. as a nation. There's increasing interdependency and interconnectivity. And so the truth is, we need to take steps to try to enhance economic growth in the short term, revitalize our critical infrastructure, and help get unemployment and underemployment down. But we must couple that with efforts to try to deal with the large and growing structural deficits that lie ahead, the ones that really represent the true threat to our ship of state, the SS United States. You know, last month was the 100th, I guess April was the 100th year anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. And the Titanic was supposed to be unsinkable. And the Titanic was sunk by an iceberg. But the iceberg that sunk the Titanic, the part that sunk it, was not the ice above the water that you could see and navigate it around, the function, equivalent of our current deficits and debt. What sunk the Titanic was the ice that was below the waterline that was multiple times greater than what you could see, which the equivalent to our federal government's finances are the tens of trillions of dollars of unfunded promises for Medicare, for Social Security, a range of other commitments and contingencies that don't represent deficits and debt today, but they will represent deficits and debt tomorrow absent a change in course. Same thing at the state and local level. The problem that California and San Francisco and many other states and localities around the country face are not as much the deficits or the debt that they face today. It's the huge underfunded pensions and retiree health obligations that are multiple times greater in many cases that will represent debt tomorrow absent a change in course. And as a result, we need to be more truthful. We need to be more transparent in order to facilitate better accountability and in order to engage in a needed transformation of what government does, how government does business, and how it measures success. In my view, at the federal level, the government has grown too big, promised too much, and waited too long to restructure. But it's not too late. And let me give you some stats. In 1900, the federal government was less than 3% of the economy. This year, it's over 24% of the economy. So it's 8 times bigger relative to the size of our economy than 1900. It's scheduled to be 37% of the U.S. economy by 2040 on our current path. If you add state and local government, government would be over 50% of the U.S. economy in 2040, which sounds like a long way off, but believe me, it's not. Think about your kids and your grandkids. I'm not an anti-government person. Some of the brightest, most dedicated, and capable people I've ever worked with are civil servants. I've run 2 agencies in the executive branch, 1 in the legislative branch. I've been a trustee of Social Security and Medicare. The fact is that they're capable people trapped in a bad system. But the truth is, government is not the engine of growth, innovation, and job creation. And you cannot allow government to get that big and expect to maintain your competitive posture, economic growth, and opportunity. And so we must change course. The same is true at the state and local level. By the way, you've all heard the saying, bad news flows downhill. When the federal government has to restructure its finances, it will have a ripple effect down to state and local governments. Today, most states rely upon the federal government for 1/3 to 42% of their revenues. And they're assuming they're going to continue to receive that. That is not a reasonable assumption. The most likely scenario is that in order to put the federal government's finances in order, it's going to have to significantly reduce future projected spending, and it's going to have to raise more revenues. So translated, that means it's going to do less than people are expecting, and people are going to have to pay more taxes than they're accustomed to paying. Both are going to happen. And if that happens, then that means the states and localities will get less, will have to finance more of their own, and it also means that individuals will have to assume more responsibility for their own financial future. Plan, save, invest, and preserve. In my personal view, our problem is primarily but not exclusively a spending problem. And that the weighting of how we solve this problem needs to be focused more on spending reductions over time rather than additional taxes over time. When you have weak economic growth and high unemployment and underemployment and deteriorating infrastructure, you don't have significant spending reductions in the face of that, and you don't have significant tax increases. On the other hand, you've got to be able to take steps to provide more certainty, stability, and credibility on how you're going to put your finances in order over time if we expect to still be able to finance our debt at reasonable rates. Right now, we have the lowest interest rates in history for the United States. And the debt that we're financing is short-term debt. So that means if and when interest rates go up, and it's more when they go up, we will feel it very quickly because we've not locked in these low rates over time. It's an equivalent of a teaser loan in many ways. When interest rates go up, for every 1% increase in interest rates, the federal government's going to have to spend $150 to $160 billion a year more for interest. And what do you get for interest? As we say in the South, shinola, nothing. So in my view, what we have to recognize is we've got to take steps to deal with our short-term and our structural challenges in an integrated, incredible, and effective manner. This election for federal office this year needs to be focused on three things: the economy, jobs, and fiscal responsibility. And they're all important on their own, but they're all interrelated, and they need to be addressed holistically. And so far, we haven't seen much talk about this in a clear, concise, incredible manner. The Republican primaries weren't full of a lot of substance in this regard. President Obama didn't have opposition in primary. And therefore, it's really, really important that this year's general election focus on this and that we try to make sure that the candidates for president first and foremost, but also for other federal offices, are pinned down on what are their views on these issues. Because the truth is, if we don't put our finances in order, everything else will suffer over time. And the truth is that once people recognize, once Europe gets its act together and people start looking at our finances, our numbers are worse than many of the countries that are in Europe. Now, we have more time, but we don't have unlimited time. And it's critically important that we make meaningful progress in 2013 in order to make sure that when people do start looking at us closer, we would have made some progress, enhanced credibility and confidence to be able to make more so that we can moderate any potential increase in interest rates that might otherwise come. Because we want to avoid passing a tipping point, because once you hit a tipping point, things can spin out of control very, very quickly. I've been to 49 states doing town hall meetings, business community leaders, editorial boards, local media. The people are ahead of the politicians. They know we have a problem. They've adjusted their behavior, but government hasn't adjusted its behavior. Believe it or not, I'm 60 years old. And do you know how many times in 60 years Congress has passed a budget and appropriations bills on time? 4 times in 60 years. And even when they pass a budget, they only control 37% of spending and declining. And the rest is on autopilot and a blank check has been written. Now, could you run your family? Could you run a business? Could I run my nonprofit having a budget that only controls 37% of spending? No. How can we run the largest entity on the face of the earth that way? The United States government. And by the way, at the state level, believe it or not, including your state counts proceeds from borrowing as revenue to balance the budget. Now, that's pretty creative accounting. At least the federal government doesn't do that, okay? So my view is this. We need to make sure that this presidential election focuses on this issue in substantive and solutions-oriented manner. We need to have at least one of the presidential debates focused on the economy, jobs, and fiscal responsibility in a way that the American people then can make a better judgment on who to support. And then whoever wins will have a mandate for action. If we are waiting for the Congress of the United States to solve our problems, we are going to be sorely disappointed. Because the Congress is a committee. Nobody's in charge of the committee. You can't run a country by committee. It is dysfunctional this year, and it will be dysfunctional next year. You may have a different party control of one or both houses, but nobody's going to have 60 members of the Senate, and nobody's going to have a significant majority control of the House, and therefore leadership will rest with the President of the United States, whoever that is, Barack Obama's second term or Mitt Romney's first term. And they must use the power of the presidency and the bully pulpit of the presidency to go directly to the American people with the facts, the truth, the tough choices, and a way forward. And then the first three words of the Constitution have to come alive. We the people who are responsible and accountable for what does or does not happen in Washington, to put pressure on elected officials, no matter their party label, to do what's right for the country rather than what's right for them and their party, so that we can avoid a debt crisis in the United States. Because if there's ever a debt crisis here, escalating interest rates, our economic challenges will be much greater than they are today, and those challenges will not be limited to the borders of the United States. Because if the largest economy on earth and the world's temporary superpower ever has a debt crisis, it will be felt around the world, and no one will be able to hide. The good news is there is a way forward. The Simpson-Bowles Commission, the Domenici-Rivlin Commission, the Comeback America initiatives, the entity that I head, our Restoring Fiscal Sanity report. There are a number of frameworks for reform out there that should be able to get broad-based bipartisan support that end up separating the short-term challenge from the structural, that recognize that everything has to be on the table, that we have to regain control of the budget. We have to reform Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid while maintaining a strong and secure safety net. We have to cut defense and constrain defense spending without compromising national security. We have to separate the wheat from the chaff between which federal government spending programs, tax policies, and regulatory actions are working and aren't working, which ones are based on the past, and which ones are trying to create a better future. We have to comprehensively reform our tax system, make it simpler, fairer, more competitive, and more equitable, and to generate adequate revenues to pay our bills and deliver on the promises we intend to keep. In my view, any comprehensive reform plan has to meet six tests to be successful and sustainable. First, it's got to make economic sense. Simply stated, pro-growth. Secondly, it's got to be socially equitable. We need a solvent, sustainable, and secure social safety net in this country. Thirdly, it's got to be culturally acceptable. It's got to envision a size of government and a level of taxation that will be supported by a majority of the American people. By the way, there's no free lunch. And the size of government is not based upon how much it taxes. The size of government is based on how much it spends. And the difference between what you spend and what you get in revenues is called a deficit, which results in debt. And the difference between, and that represents deferred taxation that our children, grandchildren, and generations unborn will have to pay, absent us changing our course. And so we also need to recognize the reality that much of the federal government is based upon conditions that existed in the world and in this country in the 1950s. How it's organized, its policies, its operational procedures, its technologies. And how does the federal government keep score? If the federal government wants to show that it cares about something, it spends more money. It gives more tax preferences. It issues a new regulation. It creates a new program. It creates a new department or agency to show that it cares. And why does it do that? Because believe it or not, this country has been in existence since 1789 as a republic. And we still don't have three things that it takes to ensure success. Number one, we have no plan. We have no strategic, forward-looking, threat, risk, opportunity-based, outcome-oriented, resource-constrained plan about what we want to do. And if you don't have that, then you throw money at it. You throw people at it. You throw organizations at it. Secondly, we have no budget. And even when we have a budget, as I said before, we're only controlling 37% of spending and going down. And thirdly, we have no outcome-based metrics. We don't have any outcome-based metrics to say what's working, what's not working, are we getting better or worse, and how do we compare to our competitor groups or our comparator groups? Give you a few examples. We're number 28 out of 34 in the world in fiscal responsibility and sustainability. Greece is 34. Australia is number one. Mexico's 18. We're 28. Which way are they going on the border this week? Okay. You know, if you look at health care, we spend double per person on health care and we get below average societal outcomes. K through 12 education, we spend double per person and we get below average results. If you think you're going to solve your problem by throwing more money at a system that you're already spending double per person and getting below average results, I hate to tell you, that ain't going to work. We're going to have to transform it, focusing on incentives, transparency, and accountability. My view is the period from September, Labor Day, until June 30, 2013, will be among the most significant in the history of our country. You have the general election campaign, and that's the only time that the American people focus in on these kinds of issues, absent a crisis. And I hope we can all agree we want to avoid a crisis. Secondly, we have the lame duck session. It's going to be the mother of all lame duck sessions. You have expiring tax provisions. You have expiring, you know, unemployment, assistance. You have expiring payroll tax relief. You have the sequester of defense and other spending that's supposed to come in. You have the expiration of the relief with regard to physician payments. You have the expiration of alternative minimum tax patch. All these things. And the difference between whether these things are happen or not on the deficit over the next 10 years is almost $8 trillion. Now, if you think they're going to solve all those problems in the lame duck session when they can't solve it, when they're in office, you're dreaming. But what's important is that we have to set up a process that will allow them to be able to make tough choices on social insurance programs and on tax policy in 2013. And in addition, the Affordable Care Act. We're going to find out in 2 weeks whether the Supreme Court is going to rule all or part of it as unconstitutional. But let me tell you, whether they do or not, it's going to be repealed and replaced. Why? Because we can't afford it. The chief actuary of Medicare estimates that the cost of that bill is $12 trillion higher than the politicians claimed. And what did government do? Medicare was already underfunded over $20 trillion, and we added a new wing onto this house that was already structurally unsound, mortgaged for more than it's worth, and headed for foreclosure. And we call that progress. So, yes, we need universal coverage for health care, but it needs to be appropriate, affordable, and sustainable. And I'm happy to get into details about what we need to do. In summary, because I want to save plenty of time for Q&A, we're a great country, but we're not as great as we think we are. We face some serious challenges. We need truth. We need transparency. We need accountability. We need leadership. We need solutions. And we need the first three words of the Constitution to come alive. We the people. This isn't for me. I'm in this fight for my country, for my kids, and for my grandkids. And in particular for my grandkids. 11, 10, and 6. They're too young to vote. They don't have a voice. I'm their voice. What's going on today is not only fiscally irresponsible, it is unethical, and it is morally reprehensible. We are mortgaging the future of our children and grandchildren at record rates. At the same time, we are reducing investments in their future. Less and less of the budget is for investment, more and more is for consumption, less and less is for young people, more and more for seniors. And in addition, they're going to face a heck of a lot tougher competition, an increasingly interconnected, interdependent, and competitive global marketplace. That's wrong. That's not discharging our stewardship responsibility. Yes, we can, no pun intended, yes, we can solve this problem. But to solve it, we need presidential leadership, and we need the first three words of the Constitution to come alive. I'll do my part. All that I ask is that you do yours. Thank you very much. I know we've got cards, and let me make it very clear. I'm very happy to get into specifics about what should we do on Social Security, what should we do on taxes, what should we do on health care, what should we do on defense, because that's what we need. We need sensible, nonpartisan solutions that can get bipartisan support.
Good. Okay, well, thank you, Dave. As I said at the outset, Dave is president and CEO of Comeback America Initiative and former U.S. Comptroller General. So let's start with the questions, and I think he's teed up some very good issues for us, and a lot of you seem to latch on to them. First question, at what percent of the national debt does the current, does the country enter the danger zone like some of those in Europe are already addressing?
Well, first you have to be careful how you keep score. There's a lot of creative accounting going on. If you look at how much public debt as a percentage of the economy we have right now, it's a little over 70%. If you count what we owe Social Security and Medicare, which you should, because it's backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, guaranteed as the principal interest, it's not going to get defaulted on, all right? It's about 105%. But if you want to compare us to other countries in Europe who finance more at the federal level and less at the state and local level, you know, add about another 25 or 30% on top of that. So first you have to determine how you keep score. If we just deal with the federal, most economists will tell you debt of 60% as a percentage of the economy is reasonable and sustainable. Most economists will tell you once you get over 90, there's a significant negative impact to economic growth, which obviously translates to opportunity, competitive posture, et cetera. My view is the most appropriate one to look at is the 104%. We're at 104 right now. We've only been over 100 twice in the history of the United States. World War II, we got something for World War II. And now, we can debate what we're getting for today's debt. By the way, At the end of World War II, we had total debt of federal debt, 122% of GDP. It went down dramatically without paying off a dime of debt by the early 80s. Why? Because we had fiscal responsibility and we grew the economy. So the numerator didn't change that much and the denominator grew dramatically. You don't have to balance the budget. You don't have to just look at how much total debt you have. You have to look at debt as a percentage of the economy. And we have to have a plan that will get the economy growing, that will restore fiscal responsibility, that will get debt as a percentage of the economy down to 60% or so, and to be able to sustain it. And the plans that I've referred to, including the Restoring Fiscal Sanity Report on our website at keepingamericagreat.org, do that.
You've now referred to the debt level at the end of the Second World War and the great progress we made because of the growth in the economy over the years between that period and 1980. But that was a different time. We came out of the war, the only country left standing. All of our adversaries were scrambling just to get their feet back on the ground. And we got a 15 or 20 year head start on everyone. We don't have that advantage going through this next period. So what do we do different to accommodate the different environment we find ourselves in?
It is a different ballgame. We have to recognize the reality. At the end of World War II, we were about 50% of the global economy. Demographics were working in our favor. We had 16 people working for every person drawing Social Security benefits. And the dollar was as good as gold. Today, the U.S. is about 25% of the global economy. There are 3.2 people working for every person drawing Social Security, and it's going to go down to 2 to 1 by around 2030, 2035 and stay there. And let's just say the dollar is not as good as gold. It's a different ball game. At the same point in time, we can learn from history and we can learn from others. We can restore fiscal discipline. We can recapture control of our budget. We can invest in critical infrastructure and human capital to try to help increase economic growth. But we have to be able to restructure a lot of these social insurance obligations while maintaining the social safety net. Let me give you an example. Medicare has three programs. Medicare Part A, mandatory, funded with a payroll tax, hospital insurance. Medicare Part B and D, voluntary. You don't have to sign up for them. Funded 25% with a premium that individuals pay and 75% with general revenues that our kids and grandkids are paying. 95% of people who sign up voluntarily for Medicare Part B and D get a 75% taxpayer subsidy for their premium irrespective of their income and wealth. 95% get a 75% subsidy for a voluntary program. The government hasn't learned the difference between universal opportunity, universal access, and universal subsidy. We have to understand the difference there. Because if you overpromise, you're not going to be able to sustain the promise for those who truly need it. And we've got similar problems on taxes, which hopefully we can get to.
Well, you've kind of touched on this, but this will be a little more direct. Do you believe that the current administration and the current Congress understand the debt and budget issue and understand that it's a serious problem that must be addressed?
Yes, they understand it's a serious problem that must be addressed, but so far we haven't seen the leadership or the will to address it. And I honestly believe that it's got to come from the president, whoever the president is. And I honestly believe that the people have to basically put the pressure on elected officials to say, the political risk of you continuing to do nothing, which they're very good at, is greater than the political risk of you making some tough choices to help avoid a debt crisis and create a better future. They're concerned with their job. Most people don't want to involuntarily lose their job. They need to understand that the risk of losing their job is greater if they continue to do nothing. Because it's not a question of if we're going to have to make these choices. The only question is, are we going to make it prudently, preemptively, and avoid a debt crisis so we have to make less choices, we have more time to phase in, fewer people are affected, or are we going to wait till we hit the wall and what has to happen is what's happened in Greece. Dramatic and draconian changes very quickly. We don't want that. We don't need that. We can avoid that. But it takes leadership, and it takes the people putting pressure on elected officials to do the right thing.
We know that Social Security is in great difficulties. Can it be saved? And if so, is it going to require a means-tested program to go forward?
Well, I was a trustee of Social Security and Medicare for 5 years. I represented the general public. Social Security does not face an immediate crisis. Even when its so-called trust fund goes to zero, it still has the ability to pay 70 to 75 cents on the dollar. But does it make sense to go to zero and cut everybody's benefits across the board, 20 to 25% irrespective of their income? No, it's stupid. All right? Social Security actually represents an opportunity to exceed the expectation of every generation of Americans. And here's why. Seniors think they're going to get taken advantage of. There are other words I could use, but I won't. Young people don't think they're going to get anything. And they're both wrong. So we can restructure Social Security so that everybody, every generation gets more than they think they're going to get. Not more than they've been promised, more than they think they're going to get. That's called exceeding expectations. Now, let's do a little test. I'm going to lay out a Social Security framework. I want you to list very carefully, and I want you to raise your hand at the end of whether or not you think this is reasonable or not as a framework. First, we need to maintain the base of Social Security as a defined benefit program. Why? Because only 50% of Americans have a pension plan, workers, and most of those have defined contribution plans where they bear all the investment risk. And they're not protected against inflation. Secondly, we have the lowest savings rate of any major industrialized nation. People aren't saving enough. And so this is truly the foundation of retirement security. There's a reason that Social Security was called Social Security. It wasn't called Social Opportunity. It was called Social Security. So let's do the following. Let's increase the benefit for people near the poverty level because we have too many people relying solely on Social Security. Let's provide a means-tested supplemental benefit for people over 85 because a lot of people are outliving their income, means-tested, not for everybody, means-tested. Let's reduce the replacement rate for middle and upper income, so you're still going to get something, but not quite as generous, so make it a more progressive system. Let's don't turn it into a welfare system by fully means-testing it, okay? Let's increase the normal and the early retirement ages prospectively, gradually, 2 to 3 years over 20 to 30 years, okay? Let's not raise the tax rate, which is a very regressive tax rate, but let's raise the taxable wage base cap, the amount of wages that are subject to taxation, from about $108,000 now to about $150,000, but don't eliminate it. Don't eliminate it. If we do that, it is solvent, sustainable, secure forever. The younger you are, the better off you are financially, the more you'll be affected, but the more time you have and the more ability you have to handle it. If you're 55 to 60 or over, you're going to have little to no changes, and the sooner we get to this, the lower that age can be. The longer we wait, the higher that age is going to be. But after doing that, let's add an automatic savings account, 2 to 3% of pay, goes into a real trust fund with real investments, with real fiduciary responsibility and liabilities the government can't touch, that's a pre-retirement death benefit, a supplemental retirement benefit, something to leave to your heirs, get our savings rate up, reduce our reliance on foreign lenders who don't necessarily share our same interest. Now, how many people think that is a reasonable framework for it? Raise your hand high. How many don't? All right, it's unanimous. I have done this all across the country, and it gets 95% plus support. So what's the problem? The biggest deficit this country has is a leadership deficit. Next.
I think that covered it quite well. Clearly, we have some serious budget problems here in California. What are some of the issues from a federal standpoint that are impacting this budget, and how are we, or what ideas do you have for getting us moving ahead and getting this behind us?
Well, first, I think we have to recognize that we face a lot of common challenges, you know, that cross boundaries, whether it's global boundaries. You know, a lot of the big challenges we face, you know, energy, environment, immigration. I mean, you know, geopolitical boundaries aren't that significant. You got to solve these problems, you know, working with others. Same thing domestically. You know, we face a lot of common challenges domestically. Healthcare costs are out of control. Tax systems are outdated. Infrastructure is deteriorating. Okay. You know, huge underfunded promises, if you will, dealing with retirement obligations. We're going to have to come together and try to solve this. So I think that there needs to be a lot more intergovernmental engagement. The last 20 years has been very limited intergovernmental engagement, and everybody's been on their own. So I think we're going to also have to think about possibly redividing division of responsibility between federal, state, and local government. For example, maybe the federal government might assume responsibility for universal health, basic and essential health, and maybe the states assume responsibility for education and critical infrastructure within their borders. All right? I think we also have to recognize that, you know, at the federal and the state and local level, we're going to have to deal with underfunded pensions and retiree health obligations, Social Security and Medicare at the federal level as well. We're going to have to modernize our tax systems, and when we modernize our tax systems, we're going to have to work together, okay? Because, you know, for example, if the federal government decided it wanted to have a VAT, or a consumption tax, we're the only major industrialized nation that doesn't have one. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying that's a fact. Well, you're going to have to coordinate that with the states, because the states rely upon the sales taxes quite a bit. If the federal government's going to do comprehensive income tax reform, well, you're going to have to coordinate with the states, because a lot of the states start off with what your federal return is and just make adjustments for that. So we have this ripple effect. I think one of the keys is truth and transparency. We got to provide a lot more truth in where we are, where we're headed, a lot more transparency about the promises that we've made as compared to others, so that we can end up restructuring in an equitable but effective manner, and that we do it sooner rather than later. You know, California is, you know, one of the things that we have on our website is how states look on liabilities and unfunded obligations per taxpayer. The best state in the union, Wyoming. Positive net worth of about $14,000 per taxpayer. Worst state in the union, unfortunately, where I live, Connecticut. Not because it's big, it's because it's per person. You know, California, I think, is around number 28 or so. And not in good shape and declining. But again, there's common challenges. Underfunded pensions, unfunded retiree health obligations, outdated tax systems. And believe me, people can move, and they are moving from California to Nevada and other places. I know some in this room that are in that category. It doesn't take much. And once you pass a tipping point, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. It'll never be what otherwise it could have been. But it's not too late.
Now, the kind of cooperation between the federal and the state that you're suggesting might be seen as almost an unnatural act. And for those of us that have tried to work with the California congressional delegation to get them to come together as a state where we have a common interest, that has been something that has never worked. What is it going to take to get these folks to realize this is their job, it must be done, and this is the avenue they have to pursue?
Leadership is what it's going to take. Okay? It's going to take the chief executive officer of the United States, the chief executive officers of the states. We're talking about making dramatic transformational changes in installments over time. And whether you're in the private sector, the public sector, the not-for-profit sector, and I've had to do it in all three sectors of the economy, it starts at the top. It starts with the new people. That's where it starts. And that's how it has to start here. That's how it has to be done here. I mean, you know.
That's going to be a challenge. Let me give you one more specific then. We have in the state of California a fairly heavy bond debt at this point. And with the budget we have, why, that presents a problem. We know there's a legal requirement for the federal government to back those bonds at any point, should that be necessary.
The state debt?
The state debt. The state debt.
What? I don't think so.
Yeah, I believe so.
I don't think so.
Well, we and I are going to debate that.
Okay. Don't bet the ranch on that one. I can tell you that right now. The question is...
Great idea.
No, I think that that's the requirement on the municipals, on the municipals.
Yeah, I don't think so. No.
But
let's
assume that for the moment if it is that it is true, because I know that's been discussed.
Okay.
What will it take to have that actually take place? Should it be necessary? I hope it doesn't come to that.
Well, first
point,
let me tell you my understanding of what is and isn't guaranteed, and then I'll answer your question. There's only two things under the Constitution of the United States that are guaranteed. Only two. Number one, bondholders of U.S. debt, federal government debt, and military pensions. Nothing else. Social Security is not guaranteed. Medicare is not guaranteed. Nothing else is guaranteed. In fact, the Supreme Court has already said they can be changed at any time, retroactively, in any way. All right? Now, just because bondholders at the federal level aren't going to not get paid doesn't mean there's not a risk. There's huge interest rate risk, and there's huge currency risk if you're a foreigner and you're investing in our debt that's denominated in the dollar. So there is risk, okay? Now, at the state and local level, there are funds that end up providing guarantees, but I don't believe the federal government provides the direct guarantee. Secondly, at the localities, that's not the case. Localities can declare bankruptcy. And Jefferson County, which is in Alabama, and I was born in Jefferson County, Alabama, had nothing to do with their bankruptcy. Let me make that clear. All right? They just declared bankruptcy. States do not have the ability to declare bankruptcy under current law because that's a federal law. And therefore, the question is, what do you do if states get in trouble? And that may be something that, you know, that could be one of the things that has to be put on the table as to whether or not states ought to have the ability to reorganize. Because my personal view is the likelihood that the federal government will bail out the state government is very low. Because the federal government has already got a negative net worth. And if you think the debt's a problem, when you add our debt and our unfunded obligations, the total financial hole at the federal level is $70 trillion. And it is growing by over $10 million a minute. So in the hour that I'll be here, okay, figure that out.
No. You touched on the Wisconsin recall. Two questions, I think. One is, what, in your view, is the likely next step to unfold as a consequence of this? Are other states going to try the same thing? Yeah. Is it going to become the way to deal with the pension issue?
Well, as I said earlier, to my knowledge, I'm not related to Governor Scott Walker. And I think the following about that situation. I think it has significant national implications, both politically and policy-wise. In my view, Governor Walker was correct in recognizing that collective bargaining rights needed to be limited. He was incorrect in saying that they needed to be eliminated. So I believe he went too far. I think they needed to be limited as it relates to bargaining over benefit levels for pensions and retiree health care. But I didn't think they needed to be limited with regard to current compensation, work rules, and contribution requirements. All right. Second, in my view, he took a more confrontational approach than was necessary. When you look at that, and you see that despite that fact, that he was kept in office by a wider margin than he was elected. And believe me, this was a national issue for the unions and for others. Why? Because believe it or not, Wisconsin was the first state to allow government workers to unionize. And Wisconsin's got less of a problem on underfunded pensions and unfunded retiree health obligations than most states. So therefore, this was the front line of a national battleground, and he won. So the result will be is you'll have many more governors and mayors and county executives will start taking a look at what needs to be done to be able to defuse this ticking time bomb. And I think, you know, you could go about it in a different way. You don't have to make necessarily as dramatic a changes as he made. But there's absolutely no question there's going to be need changes here. And I think one of the things that has to happen is, look, government workers deserve decent and competitive pension and retiree health plans. But they need to be comparable to what other major employers provide. So that means you need to benchmark the eligibility requirements, the cost-sharing requirements, the indexing issues. You have to do all of that. Put it out there. Show it. Transparency is a powerful force. And when you do that, you're going to find, in many cases but not all, they're much more lucrative than you would ever see in the private sector. And that means that since there's no free lunch, what you're basically asking taxpayers to do is the following, absent restructuring. Now, let me see if I got this right. You want me to pay much, much higher taxes over time to be able to fund pension and health benefits that are much more lucrative than I'll ever see in my life. As they say in Texas, that dog don't hunt. That ain't going to happen. But that's how you have to do it. That's how you have to do it. And it will be done in many places. And it needs to be done, especially at the municipal level, if they want to avoid bankruptcy.
We'll give you a little soft one here. In your role as the Comptroller General, what are the responsibilities and what are the major influences that you have on government operations, the economy, whatever?
The Comptroller General of the United States is, you know, in English, like the Auditor General. De facto, the Chief Accountability Officer. You're the Chief Executive Officer of something called the U.S. Government Accountability Office, the GAO. The GAO does audits, investigations, program evaluations, policy analyses, legal research, adjudications, a range of things. It works for the Congress, overseeing the executive branch. You don't work for the president. You're not part of an administration. You're like a judge. You're like a nonpartisan judge, and you have to conduct yourself that way. Now, the GAO, we led by example. By the way, when I was there, we created a plan, we had a budget, and we had performance metrics. We didn't from 1921 until 2000, but we did when I got there, okay? And after restructuring that agency, it was 13% smaller, 50 to 100% more productive, and 2 to 3 times the outcomes. And it was rated number 2 in the government in employee satisfaction and number 1 in the world for an accountability organization. And what was done there can be done elsewhere. It wasn't rocket science. It's kind of like management 101. It's transferable. It's scalable. So that's the story. And by the way, the return on investment for GAO when I left was over 100 to 1. For every dollar invested in GAO, you got over 100 bucks back. Now, my view is about Congress. If Congress was paid for performance, they would owe us money. And by the way, that's not partisan because the House is Republican and the Senate is Democrat, and it's an equal opportunity accountability here. Yeah.
Going back to the 2008 financial crisis, what, in your view, were some of the most egregious violations or practices that brought that on, and to what degree was the removal of Glass-Steagall
influencer? I think the removal of Glass-Steagall, which happened during the Clinton administration, was clearly something that allowed for increased risk. Heads we win, tails you, the taxpayer, lose. We clearly need to take a harder look at that. I don't think we've done enough in that regard. My view is that several things happen. One, the people who benefited from prevailing policies and practices were not the ones that paid the price and bore the risk when the bubble burst. There wasn't enough transparency about the nature and risk, the nature and magnitude of the risk. There was over-reliance on credit ratings. There was too much debt, not enough focus on cash flow. And the corporate and the government risk management, regulatory, and oversight practices failed. So we need to make changes in those areas. And some we have and others we haven't. Here's what I think is one of the problems. You know, we've all heard of the Tea Party. We've all heard of Occupy Wall Street. You know, one's on the right, one's on the left. They got a lot of things in common. Let me tell you what they have in common. They're not happy with the status quo. The Tea Party's not happy with the fact that government's grown too big and there's not enough accountability for failure to deliver results. Occupy Wall Street's not happy because look at all the failures that occurred with regard to the financial services meltdown and who's been held accountable. You know, making it personal, I have a daughter that lost a job and emotionally is still distressed to this day because of that. She worked in the housing industry. I have a son that lost a home, and I've lost a significant amount of my net worth as a result of that. And who's been held accountable?
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest is Dave Walker, former U.S. Controller General, who is discussing how to correct America's fiscal imbalances, especially the national debt. Staying with the 2008, we now have Dodd-Frank that is supposed to be tomorrow's version of what Glass-Steagall was for many, many years, or at least, and I understand that it's like 23 times as complicated, and about a third of it has been now put into practice, and the rest of it is still being formulated. How is that going to help?
See, I think one of the biggest problems we have right now is that we don't have certainty, and we don't have understandability with regard to our tax laws and regulatory structures. And as in my personal view, we have way too many regulations that aren't enforced. And then what we need to do is to reduce the number of regulations, streamline and simplify them, and enforce them. Because what government typically does is it'll just layer on, which means that, A, the private sector has a tough time figuring out how to comply with them. Then, secondly, the government has a tough time enforcing them, which is the worst of all worlds. Okay? So, I think Dodd-Frank is an example of that. And in our tax system, how many of you prepare your own tax return by hand without software? I do. It is an absolute abomination of a system. All right? And the reason I do that is because I can challenge senators and members of Congress to do the same thing because they can't do it. And if they had to do it, we'd have tax reform in a year. All right? So do we want to build on that kind of tax system? Uh-uh. Streamline, simplify. By the way, that'll take care of the Buffett situation. The Buffett situation exists for two reasons. Wealthy people benefit disproportionately for deductions, exemptions, credits, and exclusions. And secondly, wealthy people make most of their money through capital gains and dividends. If you broaden the tax base, streamline, simplify, eliminate, consolidate, better target these deductions, exemptions, and exclusions, if you take the top tax rate down to 25%, but you eliminate the difference between capital gains, dividends, and ordinary income, you will streamline it, you will simplify it, you'll make it more competitive, you'll make it more equitable, you'll generate a lot more money. So why hadn't we done it? What's the biggest deficit? A leadership deficit.
How do we get leadership?
What we have to do is do more than just vote. What we have to do is to recognize that the future position of the country in the world, our future standard of living at home, our future domestic tranquility, and our future national security is at stake. We have to make the economy, jobs, and fiscal responsibility the issue in this year's election. We have to make decisions on who we're going to vote for any federal office, based on how they're going to address these issues, irrespective of their party label. That's what we have to do. And we have to help people who are in office understand that doing nothing is not an option, that we must keep from going over the brink, and that we're not exempt from the laws of prudent finance. That's what we got to do. So let's do it.
Our time is up. Our thanks to Dave Walker, President and CEO of the Comeback America Initiative, the former U.S. Comptroller General. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio and television, along with the Internet. This program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's series on ethics and accountability, underwritten by the Charles Travers family, and we thank you for being here and for your support. I'm George Scalise, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Good job.